My name is Tracy Weitz, and I'm going to. I really want to thank the sponsors of this session for being willing to talk about abortion. It's a very unusual experience to be invited to the MCH, and I think we have a lot more in common between the two sections and about our work. And I think maybe this is just the beginning of bridging some of those historical divides. So I am going to talk about refusals of abortion care for conditions that threaten maternal health. And hopefully in the questions and answers section, we'll get a chance to talk a little bit more about this. So I want to start off by telling you a little story about Carla, who lives in eastern Oklahoma, and she thought she had the flu. Her family doctor referred her to an obstetrician gynecologist who discovered she was pregnant and that she had a large mass growing on her uterus. The obstetrician refused to remove the mass because it would endanger the pregnancy, and the anesthesiologist in the practice group refused to give her drugs that would harm the pregnancy. At this point, the mass was shutting off her colon and her bladder. Eventually, Carla found a doctor in another city who found that after substantial delay, he had to remove both her uterus and the pregnancy, a procedure that would have been unnecessary had the abortion been performed earlier in her pregnancy. Perhaps we'll just sit and look at a silhouette all day. Time delay and text. Well, I can go on and tell you a little bit more about Carla. Well, now after this, she's uninsured. She has a $40,000 bill from the hospital where they did the hysterectomy that she can't afford to pay, and the doctor who originally refused to do her abortion because of her pregnancy is suing her for failure to pay her original hospital bill. But these kinds of refusals, while they seem outrageous and unexplainable, really are quite normal in the health, in where we have come to understand abortion care in the United States. We're just going to go back and forth between the silhouettes. How's that? Okay, hold on. Let's try reloading. When in doubt, start over, but I will not, I won't tell the story again. Okay. It's like that old adage, you know, if your computer's not working, just turn it off and start all over again. So what I hope I'll bring you to in this morning's presentation is to begin to ponder the questions about whether there are limits to healthcare refusals and at what point the discussion about the health of the patient begins to overtake the notion of conscience, to the right to conscience. So we have a project called the Standards of Care Project, Restrictions on Women's Health, and the goal is really to investigate and to begin to document the extent to which healthcare denials of information and care conflict with professionally developed, accepted medical standards of care, and then to look at those and the health consequences. This is a project that is sponsored by the National Health Law Program, and Susan Fogel is the main author of a report that we will be launching this month. And I'm from the University of California, and we have some people working with us trying to help us figure out how to communicate this to the public. We have a national advisory board made up of people from all kinds of disciplines, internal medicine, obstetrics and gynecology, pediatrics, pharmacy, health services research, all trying to understand what are the health implications of healthcare refusals. So the overall project, we have a large technical report that looks at the medical standards of care for health conditions necessitating access to reproductive health care, looks at how those issues have been handled in the media, and then begins to try to bring this information to healthcare professionals like yourself. When we talk about healthcare refusals, the current frame is to talk about something called conscience clauses. This is a sort of an understanding that there's a conflict between the rights of the provider to individual conscience and the rights of the patient to exercise autonomy. Now, this sort of framework puts it out there that this is a moral contest, sort of a contest between the moral understanding of the provider and the moral understanding of the patient. But it fails to recognize that sort of healthcare is a very unique frame. And it decontextualizes the issue from that of healthcare. And what I mean by decontextualizing, for those of you who are public health people and not sociologists, is that healthcare itself is unique. It is illegal to perform medicine or practice nursing or distribute drugs without a license, and that the right to do those things is granted by the state. And therefore, information and access to care in the healthcare arena does not occur in an open marketplace. Rather, the information and services occur within unequal relationships, and therefore this notion that there's a sort of legitimate balance between the moral conscience of one and the moral conscience of another ignores the fact that access to care and services are sort of withheld and owned by people granted that right by the state. It takes me about 4 clicks to get to every... So, if you think about where healthcare is going in today's place, we know that we've moved from sort of a paternalistic notion that the physician knows best to a concept of evidence-based practice. That is, that the state of the science should drive where we provide care, and that people should get care that is known to be effective and not get care that is known to be ineffective. Likewise, there's a focus. Okay, this might kill me. For those of you who know me, know that I speak way too quickly to have something that moves this slowly. But there's also a focus on patient-centeredness, a sort of recognition that evidence-based practice, while it is driven by the science, does in fact also need to be patient-centered, and that individuals, based on that information, will make different choices based on their own values, but that is based in patient-centeredness. Oh, look at that. So, patient-centeredness, evidence-based practice, quality of care, all of these things are to generate the notion of wellness. That is, we no longer think we should wait until there's an infirmity or an illness before we treat, and that we should be treating ahead of time to prevent that injury or act. And that is definitely what the Pell Public Health community has for years understood, that you don't wait until illness, you do things ahead of time. And so sometimes the best outcome is a non-outcome rather than a counted outcome. So standards of care are those practices of medical necessity and services that any practitioner within the scope of their practice should be expected to render, and that it requires all healthcare professionals provide information and care consistent with the highest standard. So if you think about evidence-based practice, you think about quality of care, you think about patient-centeredness, we come up with a new framework by which to understand and evaluate health refusals. So remember that I am arguing that the patient in need includes a general claim to information and services necessary to achieve health and well-being, and that the denial of information and services can be examined through the lens employed to assess other healthcare quality, evidence-based practice, patient-centeredness, and prevention. And when we use this, we understand that denials are a violation of standard of care rather than a moral contest. So there were 3 major sources of restrictions or refusals of care. The first are what we call sort of traditional conscience clauses. These exempt both individuals and institutions from general liability. So usually when you violate a standard of care, you then are subject to liability claims. And these exempt you from those liability claims if you undergo your own conscience. Then there are things are institutional restrictions that prohibit the provision of certain services in a facility. In other words, if a hospital says you can't do abortions here, it's not based on an individual conscience, but the institution itself can prohibit the provision. It can say we're not going to cover certain services. We don't cover prenatal care. We don't cover contraceptions. And then there are political restrictions, those that come through the judicial or the legislative branch that say, for instance, the federal abortion ban, that you can't perform a particular technique. So there's 3 different types of refusals. And And just to give you a brief snapshot, 46 of the states allow individuals to refuse to provide abortion care. 43 states allow institutions to refuse to provide a care, and only one of those states, California, limits that institutional restriction to religious institutions. So all the others allow institutions to have restrictions not based on individual sort of moral teachings. And there's a trend towards new laws that sort of expand the people who are allowed to participate in healthcare refusal. So Mississippi is passing a law that says that even the admitting clerk at the hospital can refuse to admit a patient who is seeking care after an abortion service or in need of abortion services. So while once limited simply to the physician who wanted to say, I will not perform the abortion, these refusal clauses are now much bigger. And then we have a federal refusal clause within the Weldon Amendment that prohibits any states or federal actors from intervening and forcing anyone or any institution to perform abortions. And the largest sort of institutional refusal clauses come from the Catholic healthcare facilities. They control about 16% of all the beds in this hospital beds in this country. And in 2004, the five largest Catholic facilities had a $30 billion patient revenue. So these are huge institutions with lots of net profit. And they're governed by something called the Ethical and Religious Directives for Catholic Healthcare Services. These are promulgated by the Catholic bishops, and they prohibit abortion, sterilization, contraception, and most forms of assisted technologies. And they include no exceptions, and I'll talk about some of those in a minute. So what standards of care are violated? Now, our work, it deals with all four: pregnancy prevention, pregnancy termination, pregnancy attainment, and healthy sexuality. But for the purposes of today, because I only have a few minutes, I'm going to talk only about pregnancy termination, not pregnancy prevention. I'm going to talk about pregnancy termination. It's funny. It's like it starts going, and then it says no. So none of this should be sort of new news. There are about 1.3 million women who need abortions every year, pregnancy terminations that occur. There are many reasons: personal, economic, social. I'm going to talk about medical indications for abortion, both maternal and fetal medical indications, and that the standards of care are within the guidelines for particular conditions. So they are not standards of care about who should get abortions. They're standards of care about how you manage certain conditions. But those things often sort of obscure the notion of abortion by using terms like you should deliver the fetus. Well, we know that if you deliver the fetus in a 16-week pregnant woman, the early delivery of a fetus is an abortion, but it doesn't use the term abortion. It uses the term early delivery. So you won't find it in a lit search, but it's there if you read the text. So which conditions do we cover in our report? And I'll go briefly over some of them: ectopic pregnancy, premature rupture of membranes, eclampsia, preeclampsia, and HELLP syndrome, and then two chronic conditions, lupus and heart disease. It goes forward, it goes back, it goes back. This is a challenge for me. I'm 2 hours of sleep. So there are also many conditions for which the fetus is affected in these healthcare conditions, but I'm only going to talk about maternal health. This discussion this morning is only about maternal health, but recognizing that there are a lot of conditions that also affect the fetus where abortion might be an indicated within the standard of care. So ectopic pregnancy, for all of you who know, is a pregnancy that grows outside the uterus. The standard of care is to treat that individual either through medication management or through surgical intervention, and usually that's based on the patient preference. And the standards of care say it should be based on what kinds of interventions women want and what kind of future fertility a woman is interested in. Now, if you continue an ectopic pregnancy, it will result in a non-viable pregnancy. It does not grow to term outside the uterus. It can lead to rupture and internal bleeding, and it can lead to maternal death and infertility. Backward, forward, backward. So, what kinds of refusal clauses affect ectopic pregnancies? Well, at the individual level, we have examples of physicians who refuse to treat ectopic pregnancies as long as there is a fetal heartbeat present in the tube. So that we have to wait until the fetus either ruptures or dies in the tube before you will get an intervention. We have bans on abortions in public hospitals, and those bans apply to ectopic pregnancies in some institutions. And within the religious directives, they analyze ectopic pregnancy within the context of abortion. That is, you can't treat to perform the abortion. Now, you can do something that's called double effect. That is, if you intend to do one thing that is good and you get an outcome that is bad, then you have not violated the double effect. So in some institutions, that means that women get salpingostomies. That means they cut the tube to remove the tube. The goal is to remove the tube, and the fetus dies during the process of removal. Now, that is different than when you give a medication for the purposes of dissolving the pregnancy, which would be targeted directly at the pregnancy. But all of these policies differ by institutions, and they're very difficult to interpret. To give you some examples, the Sisters of Sir Francis Health Systems has a corporate policy to permit the use of methotrexate, that is the medication you would use to treat an ectopic pregnancy, in certain circumstances, but that you have to have ultracide guidance, and that the policy states that in the case of a viable extrauterine pregnancy, the criteria for double effect are met by salpingostomy, that is the removal of the tube, and not salpingostomy, that is the just going in and removing the pregnancy or evacuation. So in other words, if there is a heartbeat, you have to do surgery rather than medication management. And we saw this in the press in 2004, a case that was reported in the Pioneer Press of a woman who was refused to have a care at a hospital. And when they interviewed the physician said they couldn't treat the ectopic pregnancy because there was the presence of an embryonic heartbeat. So they're real examples. They're very confusing. They happen at both the institutional level and at the individual level. The same is true with premature rupture of membranes. That is when the amniotic fluid bursts before the pregnancy can come to term. In the second trimester, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists says you should do, it's up to the patient to decide whether or not they want to do expectant management. They want to see if the pregnancy can go to a point that the fetus can survive outside the uterus, but that should be up to the patient. And again, it can lead to sepsis, maternal death, and severe bleeding, infertility, and death when these things are happening. So where are examples of those at the individual level? Again, physicians who refuse to perform abortions, nurses who refuse to participate in abortion care. The bans on abortions in public facilities mean that you can't perform an abortion during the process of premature rupture of membranes. And the institutional levels, which again say that you can't perform the abortion until the woman is either septic, that is you're treating her infection, or you, but you can't perform the abortion, in other words, to prevent the sepsis. You have to wait until she's infected. And again, we have a beautiful example of this. It was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. If you haven't had a chance to read this, an editorial called The Question of Faith. And in it, the doctor says, you know, talks about premature rupture of membranes. The question is what to do with it. The husband and wife decide, rather than wait till she gets infected because they want this pregnancy, they're going to perform the abortion, go home, recover, and then try to see if they can continue a pregnancy to term. But because there's still a fetal heartbeat, because the pregnancy has not died, there's no intervention allowed. And the author says at the very end, if you can't read this, you may wonder, reading this vignette, how I happen to know so many details about the case, or even whether this is a fictitional teaching case that so bedevils medical students. The unfortunate truth is that this is real life, and I am the husband in the story. And what is so powerful about this particular telling is we tend to think of this as just sort of random examples that don't happen to those people who have access to power. And what he says is, in fact, these things are common, they affect everybody, and that people should begin to look at institutional refusal clauses in a big way. Great. So I talked a little bit about premature rupture of membranes, ectopic pregnancy, preeclampsia, or eclampsia or HELLP syndrome. These are hypertensive conditions. And in most parts of the world, and this is true in the United States, eclampsia is a major cause of maternal death. It causes grand mal seizures in the woman. And the only treatment known for eclampsia or for the HELLP syndrome is to deliver the fetus. That is, you need to stop the pregnancy. And of course, if you stop a pregnancy or remove a fetus prior to the point of viability, that is an abortion. So the treatment for eclampsia is abortion. But again, we have examples of refusal clauses, and in particular, the religious directives. This is a famous Catholic theologian who writes very much on this, who says that the termination of pregnancy in eclampsia is a direct abortion and therefore is prohibited. And even in understanding that the maternal risk is high, you cannot perform an abortion in these circumstances. Two chronic conditions that we talk about in our work include heart disease and lupus. And again, the American College of Cardiologists and the American Heart Association recommend that pregnancy be avoided or altogether or terminated in women with certain health conditions. And that is, these health conditions, it is a standard of care to offer abortion services. And certainly with lupus, while there's more opportunity for women with lupus to have pregnancies that are healthy, that it can lead to lupus, to advances in their disease, and at that time it has to be up to the patient whether or not to continue the pregnancy or to remove the pregnancy in order to stabilize her condition. So I hope what I've given you is just sort of a minor understanding that there are many health conditions for which there are accepted standards of care, for which abortion is one normal course of what you would expect if you had those health conditions, and that individual, institutional, and politically driven refusal clauses aren't moral contests, but in fact are the delivery of substandard care within the healthcare arena. And that we need to do something about this. And our work sort of brings together healthcare professionals like yourself to begin to ask what kinds of policy solutions are out there. And these are just some I'll sort of leave you with, and hopefully if you have other ideas, you'll come and find me later, which is to put the patient need first and to look at systems and policy structures that limit refusal clauses to individuals rather than to institutions, and to make institutions responsible for the full provision of care so that no individual is forced to provide something, but all individuals receive the information, referral, and care that they need. And to ensure that the composition of care across the country is distributed in such a way that women who need access to this care can receive this. And that we treat the violations of standards of care in the way that we do all other violations of standards of care, and that you don't get a get-out-of-jail-free card just because people feel that their conscience is violated. So thank you very much, and especially for tolerating all the little glitches in the system. It seems to be working now. I think maybe it just needed coffee. And I hope we'll have some time for questions and answers.